All right, now that Lars is here as well, I think we can start. I'm going to moderate myself, which probably means that I'll go on for about 3 hours. So when you've had enough, just start throwing things. Oh, maybe not. If you brought your mugs in, please don't. If you throw things, soft things, all right? Okay. What I'm going to do, it was a bit unfortunate that I missed my flights, etc., etc., so I didn't arrive in time to give this talk after Lee's talk. Because what I thought when I prepared it was that after some nice general introduction about R modes and instabilities, etc., I would just whack you on the head with a lot of equations and relativity, and then you would all feel saturated and basically well in tune for every talk that would follow, and you'd think, oh God, that new talk, that was really good compared to, etc., etc. Of course, now I'm giving this talk towards the end of the workshop, which is completely wrong. This is not in tune at all with what it should be. But what I will do is I will not talk about the astrophysics of R modes, instabilities, etc. What I will focus on is a very particular calculation, an attempt to calculate what would be the R modes in GR. So these are relativistic perturbations, not the Newtonian ones that we're all quite familiar with by now. And I should say that most of this work was done by Keith Lockage in his thesis, supervised by John Friedman, and then I came in from the side and I did some complementary things, and we combined it all into a huge paper that subsequently became two papers, subsequently became three papers, and now the first paper is 60 pages long or something, has been submitted, and the others are sort of very long drafts that exist or not, etc. But maybe on a 15-year timescale, we're actually going to finish this and solve this problem. All right. So why would we want to do this? Well, an obvious reason for working on the R modes and such is that, as many people in this audience, we want to understand what the astrophysical significance of this effect, etc., might be. But I think it's important to emphasize, and I think Bernard's talk just before lunch did this in an absolutely fantastic way, it's important to emphasize that despite a lot of sort of interesting suggestions of what the astrophysics might be and how it might work, everything we have is very, very basic. I mean, there are error bars in everything people say that are at least as large as the numbers that are quoted themselves, right? So we have to be very careful here before we get carried away. And obviously, some issues, quite a lot of issues, I think, rely on us actually taking the modeling of the R modes themselves to further detail. So we want to do more realistic stellar models. We want to look at instabilities. I mean, after all, the CFS instability is a relativistic effect. We need to look at the modes in relativity, right? We want to understand radiation reaction probably beyond the quadrupole multipole formula. We need to do that by going into relativity, right? We want to calculate things with different realistic equations of state. We can only do that in relativity because there is not a one-to-one correspondence between a stellar model with a certain central density, mass, and radius in Newtonian theory to a similar model in GR. So if we want to do this, we need to do this problem in relativity, right? So that's what we set out to do. What I'm going to tell you about here is sort of the first step towards that goal, because as it turns out, it is a bit intricate. So what I'll do, I'll sketch my flashing transparencies at a frantic rate, transparencies with a lot of equations. I have to do that these days, you see, because I'm a mathematician, so I have to show you loads of mathematics. It doesn't make any sense, but at least I can pretend that I understand it. So I'm going to try to underline again what the R modes are in the Newtonian picture, and then I'm going to move on and compare that, the Newtonian understanding, to the situation in relativity, right? Doing that, I'm going to sketch a little bit what the problem looks like in GR, and then I'm going to show you some results at the first post-Newtonian level. Technically, we have results that are fully relativistic as well, but some of the numerics is still a bit dodgy there. We have some problems with convergence and stuff. So, all right. So let me just remind you I know this is an insult, but I'll do it anyway. What the problem is in Newtonian theory. So in Newtonian theory, you need to look at the linearized Euler equations. You need to have the conservation of mass, and if you want to include the gravitational potential, you want to have the Poisson equation as well. And then, in addition to those, if you want to close this system and actually calculate modes, you need to have an equation of state relating the perturbations, right? The standard way to do that is just to assume that you have an adiabatic perturbation and just introduce an adiabatic index gamma 1 that relates the Lagrangian perturbations in pressure and density like that. Right, now if you write this into the Eulerian form, relating the Eulerian perturbations, the little deltas, then you end up with this relationship here with an extra term that is called normally the Schwarzschild discriminant. And as most of you know, this is a key quantity for convective stability, and it's also a key quantity that pops up and determines whether there are G-modes, etc., and what the frequencies of the G-modes would be. Right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to contrast the case when the Schwarzschild discriminant is zero, i.e. when the perturbations have the same equation of state as the background star. We call that isentropic stars. Right? I'm going to contrast that to the case when the Schwarzschild discriminant is non-zero, i.e. when G-modes are non-zero, etc., so the G-modes are distinct, which is the non-isentropic case. So I'm going to look at both of those cases, first in Newtonian theory, and just sketch what happens, and then I'm going to do the same in GR, because it turns out that in GR, this is an important distinction, as it is in Newtonian, of course. All right. So some further bit of trivia. When you want to look at perturbations of a rotating star, it's no longer sufficient to say that we can decompose any perturbation in terms of either spheroidal type vectors, which I'm going to call polar, according to Chandra's terminology, which can be written as a radial displacement, or either as spherical harmonics or gradient of the spherical harmonics. And then the axial perturbations, which are the R-mode type, that sort of have the magnetic multipoles describing the angular dependency. Right? Now, if you want to describe a non-rotating star, these two vectors always decompose. They're completely independent. You can look at either polar modes, the EF modes, the P modes, the G modes, or the axial modes, which would be like the toroidal modes in the crust, for example, as we heard about this morning. If you want to look at a rotating star, you can't do that anymore. Rather, you'd expect these two classes, these two vectors to couple in some intricate way. And the faster your star rotates, the more complicated this coupling gets, and the more of these guys you have to enter. Basically, the more of the various Ls you have to couple into it to describe the fluid motion. But one thing you can do, basically because the rotating star itself, the equilibrium configuration is invariant under parity, you can still look at a perturbation as having a distinct parity state. Right? So as you take a non-rotating star, take a mode of the non-rotating star, determine its parity, you spin the star up, the parity of that mode will not change. Right? So you can still meaningfully distinguish between sort of an axial mode and a polar mode if you by that mean something that limits to something with a distinct parity in the non-rotating case. I'd say it's a bit intricate how this works out. But what will happen is that the parity, in order to keep the parity unchanged, you need to couple in more and more multiples into describing the fluid velocity as you spin the star up. Right. So that makes the problem a bit difficult, especially if you want to go to fast rotation. But it should be pointed out, you can still always decompose the azimuthal angle, the phi angle, in the standard Fourier way. So that works out, which is nice. Okay, now.
Sorry, I don't understand that statement about parity. For non-rotating stars, when zero frequency is such that
Right. 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 Well, the statement is that you will not have a distinct mode that limits to a combination of those, right? They will limit to something that has a given parity, right? So you would have, say, an L equals 2 toroidal mode plus an L equals 3 spheroidal mode in the zero frequency limit, right? And when you then move up to the rotating sequence, that has a given parity. So you're right, but you have to take different values of L's, if you like.
Is it true that if you had a general mode that was a combination, you could split it into a part with a new variable part, and each part separately satisfy the same value?
Yes.
That's, I guess that's what you
said. No, that is true. Yeah, that is true. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to look at low-frequency modes, because that's where the R modes live. Right? And as Bernard said, if you take a non-rotating star, then there is a degenerate spectrum of zero frequency modes. And it turns out that this is what we need to understand if we want to do the relativistic calculation. So I'm going to sketch this for the Newtonian case, right, and then move on. Now, if we start off looking at the isentropic case, and we assume that the perturbations are stationary, so we just throw away all the time derivatives, we end up with these two equations, right, from the conservation of conservation of mass and the Euler equations. And now we can look at these, we can probably stare ourselves blind at them, but we can immediately see that these two equations decouple, and the solutions will be a combination of solutions where the velocity is non-zero, but all these guys, the delta rho, delta p, and delta phi, vanish, and ones where the velocity is zero, right? And the other guys are not. Now, if you think about this a little bit, actually, you can make this mathematically precise, but I don't think we want to do that now. If you think about this, you can convince yourself that the second class here, where you have a non-zero pressure, density, and gravitational potential perturbation, but a zero velocity, you can convince yourself that that is actually just a neighboring equilibrium to your star. Right? So that's essentially nothing new. It just means that instead of looking at that star, this is a perturbation that takes you into some other star that's close to it. So that dynamical perturbations that we're interested in will belong to the first class, where you have zero pressure, density perturbations, etc., but a non-zero velocity, right? And if we assume that, then the only equation we need to play with is the first one. And now if we put into that an axial type displacement, an R-mode type displacement, then we see that this equation then puts no constraints or no restrictions whatsoever on the velocity field. Can be freely specified, all axial vectors will satisfy that equation. Right? Do the same thing for the spheroidal, we just find that one function is still undetermined. It's either the horizontal part of the velocity field or the radial displacement, but one of them is still free. Okay. If we play the same game, so that's the isentropic case, we play the same game for the non-isentropic case when the Schwarzschild discriminant is non-zero, that is, we have a stable stratification in the star, then this degeneracy is broken, and the G-modes fall out of this class here. Right? And the frequency of the G-modes is roughly proportional to the Schwarzschild discriminant and the gravitational acceleration. So that sort of comes out of the mathematics. So that means that the only thing that we're left with in the isentropic, non-isentropic case is a zero set of zero frequency axial modes, whereas in the other case we've got both axial and polar modes, right? And now we switch on rotation. So then what happens is that enter the Coriolis force, and it breaks the degeneracy of the zero frequency subspace. The R modes come into play both for isentropic and non-isentropic stars. And in the case of isentropic stars, we also get a sort of rotationally driven polar modes. That then, if we switch on the Schwarzschild discriminant, becomes the G modes. Right. So basically, what happens? You've seen the R mode frequency before. I'm just writing it down here because I'm going to contrast it at the end to what to the result in relativity. And then we want to calculate the velocity field, and I'm sure, even though I'm unfortunately missed Lee's talk, I'm sure he showed you that if you want to do this, you need to go to second order in rotation. And when you do that, you find for isentropic stars that there is one single R mode for L equals to M. For non-isentropic stars, you get an infinite set for all L's and all non-zero M's. So these two cases are very different indeed. In the non-isentropic case, as I've said, you also have the G modes. And in the isentropic case, you get a strange set, maybe intuitively strange if you're used to sort of the P mode, G mode calculations. You get a strange set of hybrid modes that is a combination of the two. So it's sort of when you go to the zero frequency limit, the zero rotation limit, these have a mixed nature. So those are the modes that Bernard sort of asked about how I could have these. Now you do get those, but they have to come with, as I said, different spherical harmonics in them, basically. All right. Now, so that's a bit of a long preamble. But now what I want to do is I want to do that very same calculation, but in GR. Right. So just to sketch the relativistic problems without too much tedious long equations. What we want to do is a standard problem of perturbing a relativistic star in the slow rotation limit. So then the metric is essentially the normal spherical metric with an extra term, the last term here, where the omega simply describes the frame dragging. Fortunately, at linear order in omega, which is all I'm going to do here, because it turns out that the equations are messy enough at this level, the star is still spherical, so the configuration, the equations for the pressure and the metric quantities nu and lambda, are still the standard TOV equations. So that's something I know how to solve. And then we get one more equation, which describes the frame drag, and it's just a second order ODE, so that's hopefully something I can solve as well. Because otherwise I can't even perform at the level of people that had used computers 30 years ago. So I think maybe that would be a bit pathetic. All right. So essentially you solve for the frame dragging, and by doing that you find out what the angular momentum of your configuration is by matching it to this form in the exterior vacuum. And then we have the real problem. We want to calculate schematically perturbations of the metric, with that as our background. We want to plonk this in, plus some velocity field, into the perturbed Einstein equations and the equations of motion. And then we want to pick a subset of these after choosing some suitable gauge, write down some equations that we can solve, and there we are. Right. So now what I could do, maybe what I should do to send you all safely off to sleep, to show you what these equations look like. Now, I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to just give you a little bit of notation, because I'm going to relate some of these quantities later on. So don't get too frightened by this transparency. What I want to point out is the notation I'm using is such that the axial, I mean the R mode type metric perturbations are in terms of little h naught and little h1, right? And along with that comes a velocity field that is in terms of capital U, right? These are my axial quantities. So those would be the R mode quantities, if you like. My polar quantities are the capital letter metric perturbations and velocity fields capital V and capital W, right? That's all you need to take home from this. All this other stuff is not particularly relevant. All right. And now what we'll do is we'll ask, okay, so we've understood how the R modes fall out of the zero frequency limit in the Newtonian case, right? So let's look at the zero frequency limit in the GR case. So you do that, you write down the set of perturbed Einstein equations or equations of motion that you've chosen, sufficient number to close the problem. And you stare at these equations, and after a while you might see that again you can decouple this into two distinct classes. Of course you wouldn't see this unless you'd done the Newtonian problem, so you actually knew what you were looking for. Right? But since we did the Newtonian problem, we can see it. So here what happens is that we get two solutions, again, two classes of solutions. One where you have the zero pressure and density variations, plus some of the metric variables vanishing, right? Which is this class here. So obviously these are the pressure and density, energy density perturbations, plus some of the polar metric variables, right? And then I get a class which has all the axial quantities that remain, but also some polar ones. That is the velocity field V and W and the polar metric quantity H1. And the other class, all the others vanish in these ones. Well, these guys vanish and these other ones are non-zero. Now, this splitting might look, you know, these are just symbols here. They don't make much sense to you. But if you look at the metric, the perturbed metric, you see that this class here has vanishing TR, T theta, and T phi components of the perturbed metric. Now, that basically says that these represent static solutions. So that means that we could, again, interpret this as being a neighboring spherical star. Right? So these the second class of perturbations, again, just like in the Newtonian case, it's essentially a neighboring star. And the first class are the dynamical perturbations that we're interested in. And then, if we write down the equations that relate these variables now, we have the following set. So this is just work that was actually done by Thorne and Campolattaro in the late 60s. So now we're catching up. Just got another 30 years to go and we'll be really up to date. Okay? But what you can see now, if you think back to what I showed you about the Newtonian problem, what you can see is that we've got 1, 2, 3 equations for H1, W, capital V, H naught, little h naught, and U. So we've got 3 equations for 5 variables. Right? Furthermore, they decouple. So this guy, if you're given U, capital U, you'll find out little h naught. Right? But one of these is freely specifiable. Right? For the polar quantities, capital V, W, and capital H1, it's the same story. One is freely specifiable, the other two fall out from these equations. Right? So that's exactly the structure of the Newtonian problem. You specify one function, you can calculate the rest. Okay, so these are three of the equations that I need, eventually. I need a bit more. So far, the problem looks pretty much like the Newtonian one. Now you can go on and try to solve these. Sorry, I should use these again. And you can convince yourself that this guy here is fine. If you provide me with a capital U, then you can solve this, satisfying all the necessary boundary conditions, etc., and find a zero frequency axial type solution. Right? So this is, again, an axial solution that belongs to the zero frequency subspace. Now, if you want to do the same with these two equations, you end up in trouble in the case when the star is non-isentropic. Now that's essentially the statement that in that case G modes will exist and therefore they will sort of be lifted out of this zero frequency space by the stratification. So what you find is an R mode solution will belong to this zero frequency subspace only in the case of isentropic, no, making no sense at all, which is probably good. All right, so the bottom line is exactly the opposite to what I was trying to say, which is probably doesn't make any difference then. If I say it twice, then maybe it will invert itself. All right, so in the isentropic case, the zero frequency modes will be both of axial and polar quantity or parity. So if you think about it then that the R modes and the G modes both have zero frequency. If you make the star non-isentropic, just like in Newtonian, the G modes become distinct and the R modes are the only zero frequency modes you have. right? So then, what we want to do is, obviously now is the gist of the entire thing, last few minutes. We want to try to calculate what happens when we spin the star up. But we know now what we expect the limit to be, right? So we want to have something that has, and what we're particularly interested in, for obvious reasons, is what happens to the Newtonian R modes when you go into GR. Right? So we want something that limits to the Newtonian modes in the appropriate limit. Right? That's the ones we're looking for. We're not trying to solve this problem in general and find every single mode of a slowly rotating star, because even though technically we have the machinery, it would take a bit too much time. So what we're looking for something is we're looking for a mode that has a purely axial leading order velocity field, if we can find such a mode, right? And in the non-isentropic case, based on just looking at the equations, not trying to solve them yet, we can see that it's plausible that such a mode will exist. And if it does, it would have an axial velocity field and metrics, etc., to leading order, and all the other metrics, the pressure, etc., would be higher order in omega. So they would enter in, be coupled in, just like in the Newtonian problem, but at higher orders. In the isentropic case, we find that you can't have such a mode. So therefore, the conjecture is that what will happen is exactly what happens in the Newtonian case, that you need also the polar velocity field to leading order. Right? And then what we'll do, so we'll go back to the Einstein equations, but now we're going to go to higher order terms in omega, and hopefully what will happen is that out from these equations will fall into our lap some equations that contain only the terms that are of order 1 in this assumption. So in the non-isentropic case, those would be equations that contain only these two quantities. Right? Then the degeneracy of the zero frequency modes is split already at leading order. And that's what we're looking for. So in the other case, in the isentropic case, we're looking for something that contains U, H naught, WV, and H1. So that's a more complicated problem. Now, let's look at these two cases separately. The non-isentropic case was the first one to be done. In fact, the equation that you get, it turns out that you can do this. The equation is a single second order ODE for little h naught, the metric variable. This equation was first written down by Kojima several years ago now. And he argued that based on this equation, the R modes will have a continuous spectrum. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a minute, towards the end of this transparency, to that statement. So basically what this equation says, just look at it, what I've done is I've scaled out the rotation frequency. I can do that because this is a linear problem. This is first order in rotations. Everything should scale with the rotation rate. I've introduced a suitable mode frequency. So this is the inertial mode frequency, where I've replaced sigma, the frequency itself, with an eigenvalue alpha. And if I do that, you can look at this equation and see that all dependency on rotation is scaled out. All the dependency of the azimuthal eigenvalue m, little m, is scaled out. So if I find a solution to this, it's valid for all values of little m. Right? Yes, that's a very good question. It enters at next order in rotation because it relates the radial displacement to the pressure and density variations, right? So it actually comes in at order omega squared. That's right. Basically, it's what saves you. If you couldn't make that statement, then this equation is useless, right? But because these things enter at higher order, at this level you're fine, right? No. Basically, what will happen is that if you find something at this level, right, it will be degenerate. And when you go to the next level, where the Brunt-Weissel frequency comes in, into play, this degeneracy will be broken. Right? But to write down those equations is horribly complicated. So at the moment, that's not. But basically, what we have here is the same thing as in Newtonian. If we find a solution here at this level, it will be a single R mode, right, for each L and M. That's exactly what you find at leading order in Newtonian, when you can't determine the radial eigenfunctions, right, but you can get the frequency. So then in that sense, it's exactly what you would expect. Now, you can look at this equation with a bit more mathematics and actually prove that the only way that you can have a non-trivial solution is when the eigenvalue alpha lies in the range such that this difference, the prefactor of the highest derivative in the equation, vanishes at some point in your space. So it has to vanish either in between the center of the star and infinity. Right? Now, that means that it translates into the eigenvalue lying somewhere in between the value of the frame dragging at the center of the star and the rotation frequency as you see it at infinity. So the permissible range of eigenvalues is sort of spread out, but at least it's a bit restricted. Now, you would probably hope that this collapses down then to something that reminds you of the Newtonian result. And it does indeed, because as the star becomes less relativistic, the frame dragging scaled in this way at the center goes to 1, so therefore this range shrinks down, and you end up saying that the mode has to have the Newtonian eigenfrequency. Right? So that's nice. But unfortunately, what it also does is it says that this eigenvalue problem has to be a singular one, because the prefactor of the highest derivative vanishes at some point in your space. And that led Kojima to state that the R modes of a relativistic star have a continuous spectrum with frequency in this range. Right? And that was backed up, that statement was later on backed up by Beyer and Cocytus, who basically brought in some more mathematics machinery to show that there would be a continuous spectrum for this equation. Okay? So now I'm not going to talk about a continuous spectrum anymore, because there might be a continuous spectrum, there might not be. There are, you can make arguments either way. But in my view, it is not reasonable that a mode that is perfectly distinct in Newtonian theory suddenly becomes a part of a continuous spectrum when you switch on GR. The reason is that a distinct mode has a clear, well-defined eigenfunction, and a part of a continuous spectrum does not. And therefore, I don't particularly like that idea. So what we wanted to do is to see, basically like a pig-headed man, I wanted to go into this and say there has to be a distinct mode. There has to be a distinct mode solution, or I won't play anymore. So later on, I'm going to show you that indeed there is a distinct mode. But first of all, let's just comment on what happens in the other case. First of all, in the isentropic case, you can prove that there will not be a pure R-mode solution. So while in Newtonian theory we have that single L equals M mode, in GR there are no such solutions. Every solution to this problem will be a mixture of axial and polar, the axial and polar vectors. Right? So that's maybe a little bit uncomfortable, but quite interesting. This means that all modes that we expect to find, low-frequency modes that we expect to find, will be of a hybrid kind of nature that has both these velocity fields mixed. If you go on, you can look at the equations and say that actually they look almost exactly like the Newtonian ones, and therefore the result that we should find should be very similar to the one that was found by Lokich and Friedman in the Newtonian case. And that's sort of where we are at the moment, because we're struggling to get our numerics to converge for a star of neutron star compactness. Works fine up to something that's twice as big, but when we get it down, it's a little bit iffy. So that's something that I hope to sort out in a couple of weeks' time. So now then, the last few minutes. Maybe I should sit down and give myself 5 minutes. All right, so what we did, just to get a feeling for what will happen, is we went for a calculation of the first post-Newtonian corrections to the Newtonian R-modes. If nothing else, it gives us a nice illustration of how the relativistic effects sort of enter into this game. So that means you take the Newtonian mode frequency, here I've just written it as a sort of dimensionless part of the co-rotating frequency. You take the Newtonian value and you tag on a post-Newtonian correction. Right? And you do the same for the metrics. Obviously the metric has to basically vanish as you go to the, or the metric perturbations have to vanish as you go to the Newtonian limit, and the velocity field has to become order one. So in the non-isentropic case, I just go back to that second order ODE that I have, and I try to solve it. And we find that you can do that. So there is one single solution to that problem corresponding to an eigenvalue that I will show you quite soon. And the only thing that is different between the relativistic and the Newtonian case is that in the relativistic case, we can solve for the eigenfunctions, the velocity field, already at order omega. We don't need to go to the next order. That's the only thing that's different, and that's basically brought into play by the post-Newtonian corrections. The isentropic case is more complicated. Then what we did, we expanded all the equations in post-Newtonian orders, and then assumed that what we were looking for was something that looked like the R-mode to leading order. So that's something that had this axial velocity field that you've seen a lot of times. And then, the Newtonian eigenfrequency plus corrections to the velocity field, and post-Newtonian order corrections to all the other variables. And then we just truncated the series in spherical harmonics as early as we could, right, to make the problem as easy as possible. Now, you then find that we can find such a solution. So that says that, well, it seems consistent, the assumptions we made. And what you see is that, again, we have a correction. It's actually spelled out exactly there. The post-Newtonian correction to the mode frequency. You see that, again, the metric variables are all of post-Newtonian order, so that seems all right. And you can see that we also pick up extra polar velocity fields at post-Newtonian order. Right. So in the Newtonian limit, this falls back into exactly what you have in all these Newtonian papers. So now then, to conclude, I'm going to try to comment on Lars's question, because I think this is a key question. I've made a clear split between the isentropic and the non-isentropic cases, but yet, in the equations that I have, the Schwarzschild discriminant is nowhere present. And that, I think, one might be a bit uncomfortable with that. And we were indeed quite uncomfortable with that. So the way we see it is that mathematically that's quite sound, because you can take each case and say, well, this is just the way this case works out, and it's not clear what happens, you know, if you want to take the isentropic limit. It's not clear how to do that at this level. But we figure that we have two solutions here to two seemingly quite different problems. But it has to be, physically, that if you take a non-isentropic star and you go to the isentropic case, the mode that we're interested in shouldn't change too much, right? Because that's what happens in the Newtonian case. So one way of showing that is to look at the eigenfunctions. So this is a graph of the two axial metric perturbations in the two cases. And you can see that they are very close. So just as in the Newtonian case, they race from the go up from the center, it's roughly a power law, but close to the surface, they sort of fall back. So this is what the velocity field will look like. But in addition, in the isentropic case, we got a load of other things as well. So on this transparency, we're comparing the dashed line still being the non-isentropic solution, where we only have the axial velocity field. The solid line is the polar one. And then we have all these other polar velocity fields, roughly a factor of 100 smaller. Right? So they're present, but they're very small. So the baseline, bottom line is that you can probably assume that these are roughly pure R-modes, even though mathematically they're not. So to conclude, just to give you a ballpark of the difference in the frequency, if you're willing to think of things at a precision of maybe 5% accuracy, which I think is stunningly accurate on an astrophysical level anyway, what happens is basically that in the R-mode eigenfrequency, you have to replace the rotation rate in this term with the frame dragging at the surface. Right? That turns out to be quite accurate. As you go up to higher order Ls, this is the limit that the modes seem to approach. Right? Now, that means that the mode frequency is smaller as you increase, sort of increase the relevance of relativity. The mode frequency gets smaller, which is perfectly natural for several reasons. First of all, that's what you would expect from the gravitational redshift. Secondly, these modes are driven by the Coriolis force. The Coriolis force acts, or the strength of the Coriolis force depends not on the angular velocity as measured by an inertial observer at infinity in GR, but by a local observer, so that is the difference between the rotation frequency, the uniform rotation frequency, and the frame dragging. And that is my omega bar in this equation. So it's natural that you see get this decrease. Okay. So I'm going to stop there and just leave you with that little box saying that this is, I believe, the picture that we have. We don't exactly know how to tie these together, but this is what we have. Newtonian theory, at order omega squared, we have an infinite set of R-modes for each L and M, for non-isentropic stars, and obviously the G-modes as well. Isentropic, we have the single R-mode for L equals to M, and a huge set of hybrid modes. Right? And then Yoshida and Lee, in a nice paper, have sort of argued how these you can go from this guy to that guy. Right? But there's more work needed if you want to understand that proper. What we've done in this work, I believe, is we've started to tie the boxes together in this way. So we now understand, I think, that non-isentropic relativistic stars have a single R-mode for each L and M. There's an infinite set of G-modes, of course, and there might be, but we don't know, a continuous spectrum as well. And in the isentropic case, there simply aren't any pure R-modes. All modes have a hybrid nature. What we haven't done is we haven't done that. But you have to leave some work for someone else to do, especially when you get tired. So thanks for listening. Right.
So you ask the same question. If a star with finite thrust and a star that's isentropic, you ask the calculation different than the surface wave, the top of the surface.
Right.
Especially with buoyancy, the surface buoyancy is much stronger. So the fact that the two agree, is that the same statement as the
I agree with you. The way I think about it is that the L equals to M R modes that we see is basically to do with the shape of the star. So it's a surface effect. And that's why it's natural that when you write, if you were to write down what frequency do you expect in the relativistic case, don't do any calculations. Just write something down. You're going to write down the frame dragging at the surface of the star 9 times out of 10. Right? And that's why it's quite satisfactory after about 3 years worth of work that that's the only result that you have.
So I don't see why.
No, sorry. Let me, I should have added something to this little table earlier. This is an order omega squared result, right? This is an order omega result. When I take this to order omega squared, I'm going to get an infinite set. Okay, so the stratification is going to break this degeneracy. I realize that, you know, that this is a bit sort of shoddy workmanship, I would say, not to put that information in. Right?
Oh. Grasp the eigenfunctions, if you have one set of eigenfunctions where a factor of 100 is smaller than the other.
Yes.
What, for the relativistic model that you computed those for, what was M over R? If you would expect all of those guys to go to zero in the Newtonian limit.
That's right. So M over R for this one is 0.2. So that's the neutron star sized object. So that my view is that they are actually surprisingly small.
Yeah, small.
It's
I have a semantic question. Why do you use the term isentropic rather than
isotropic? Oh. Well, it's a matter of taste, and we had the discussions about this a couple of years ago, and I caved in. So that's my answer. That's what John Friedman likes, so I caved in. I mean, you win some, and when there's one you realize you can't win, you just cave in. So that's my answer. I know it's not a very good one, but anyway. All right, well, now that I've run over time in a serious way. Okay. Yes? Yes. Yes. Yes.
Okay. So I keep telling them that it's not irrelevant for real neutron star because it's not isotropic. Okay. So what I was saying basically, combining basically that doesn't make a difference because the quality of difference is more coupled.
Well, it seems to me that it's my pile of someone. Had a look at to what extent, for example, the reason why one would say, I think the only reason why one would say that a neutron star is non-isotropic is because the compensation for it.
No,
that's fine. But then, what we need to do is we simply need to look at to what extent that puts this star, as far as the R nodes or all the nodes are concerned, closer or close to the isotropic calculation or not. I mean, and that is a calculation that's quite easy.